start with something we've spoken about in the past, but to enlarge upon it a little bit more than we've spoken about in the past. This week's Sedra, the coming Sedra, starts off with the mitzvah of Bikurim, the first fruits. And we find in the Torah many mitzvahs that have to do with firsts. The firsts are always special. They're always dedicated to God. First fruits, firstborn, first shearing of the wool, reishis digoncha, truma is called reishis, the beginning of your grain, challah, beginning of the dough, reishis arisoseichem. All the ratios, all the firsts are special. Why? Now, I am a firstborn, so I have no trouble believing that the first is always best. But my brothers, aleihem hashalom, may not have agreed with that. And they're right. The first is not always the best. In this case, it was. But in any case, there are situations where the first is not necessarily the best. Huh? Kai, yeah, okay. There are situations where the first is not the best. So why didn't the Torah say, bring me a few samples, the first, the second, the third, bring me the best? Why the first? What's so special about the first? So there are basically three ideas why firsts are special and why the Rabbanu Shalom wants us to dedicate the first to him. There are other ideas also. These are three that I want to mention. The first is that firsts serve as the foundation of everything that comes afterwards. It's not just the beginning, but it's a foundation. And when you build a building, if the foundation has even a hairline crack, even if the building is very, very strong, there's danger that it's going to fall down. On the other hand, if the foundation is as perfect as it can be, even if the building itself is not so strong, the chances are that it's going to stand. The foundation is what everything stands on, or it's like the root. If the root is even blemished a little bit, the blemish will come out a thousandfold in the plant. But if the root is okay, a small blemish on the leaf or on the stem is not going to make that much of a problem. The same that a blemish in the root is going to cause destruction of the plant. So the reishis forms the root and the foundation of everything that comes afterwards. And therefore, we want the reishis, the first, to be as perfect as possible. When you're setting the foundation, you want it to be as perfect as possible. And therefore, the Torah demands that all firsts are dedicated directly to God, sets the pattern for everything that's going to follow. Example in the Sedra, that you bring your first fruits and you dedicate them to God, you give them to the Kohen, then all the fruits that you'll have after that, you're not going to use them holy of holies. You're going to eat them, but at least you'll eat them with some kind of holy thought. You'll eat them with the right intention. You'll eat them for the right purpose. Because you've set the foundation to be holy of holies, then everything that follows will at least be minimally holy and on the right track. You're building on a firm foundation. That's one idea. Second idea. When it comes to Torah and mitzvahs, there is a tremendous importance in accepting upon yourself what to do, even if you haven't done it yet. Commit yourself. A commitment is a very, very important thing. The Rabbeinu Yonah comments on the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says that a person whose maisim are more than his chachma, ma'isav merubim al chachma, so he does more than he knows, so his chachma will remain. But somebody who knows more than he does, his chachma will not remain. Chachma has to be realized. It has to be expressed in action. And if it's not, it remains theoretical, it's not going to remain. If you just know, but you don't do, the chachma is going to dissipate. Says the Rabbeinu Yonah, how can you do more than you know? You can't do some things you don't know what you're supposed to do. So how is it ever possible that a person can do more than he knows? That's the question. You could do what you know, less than you know. How can you do more than you know? So he says the following. He says the way of doing more than you know is by committing yourself to do anything that you'll ever learn. And the commitment itself is considered like you did it. There's a Me'iri who says a similar idea. The Me'iri says that if a person commits himself to do tshuva, he hasn't done tshuva yet. And there's a lot of things that that go into making the foundation of what tshuva is, that if you don't do them, you don't fulfill the mitzvah. For instance, you have to verbally confess your sin. You have to return stolen articles that you stole before you can do tshuva. I can't do tshuva and aveira, and I didn't give back the stolen property, if that was the sin. Right? I have to ask forgiveness from the person that I wronged. If he doesn't give me forgiveness, I can't do tshuva on a sin that affected somebody else if I don't get his mechila, his forgiveness. Even though all these conditions are true, but if I commit myself to doing them, even though I haven't yet had a chance to do them, I'm considered already a different person from the time I made the commitment. Meaning if I really mean it, and I really am going to do it. If it's just a matter of carrying it out in time, but the commitment is there, then the commitment already changes me, says the Me'iri. If I was a Rasha before because I had all these sins, and I committed myself to do tshuva, even if I haven't actually done it yet, I'm considered a chassid, a tzaddik, because I've changed my stature just with the commitment. And that's what it says in the end of this week's Sedra. The end of the Sedra, towards the end, it says there were 11 curses and blessings that were given. One of them was, it's not a curse on someone who does not fulfill the entire Torah, because if it would be, we'd all be in real bad sorrows. Because, speaking for myself, it's very difficult to keep all the Torah. Right? We're not perfect, none of us. So if it would be a curse on someone who does not keep the entire Torah, it'd be pretty bad. So what is the curse and what is the blessing? Or asher lo yakim means a person who doesn't commit himself to keep the Torah. We'd all like to keep the whole Torah, except we have a Yetzirah and it's difficult and we're lazy and we're careless and a million other excuses. But the commitment is there. It's not that I say, you know, what's it called? 613 mitzvahs, I'm only going to do 612. One I don't hold from, right? I don't like the mitzvah, whatever it may be, okay? The mitzvah of eating meat taken from a live animal, that one I'm not accepting. Every other mitzvah I'm going to do, and I do them perfectly, as opposed to somebody who says, I accept upon myself oral 613 mitzvahs, but I'm weak. I can't do this one, I can't do that one. I know I'm going to get punished for it. I accept my responsibility. I just can't do it. That person will be punished for his sins, but he's within the community of Shomrei Torah mitzvahs. Somebody who keeps 612 mitzvahs, but refuses to accept any one mitzvah as binding, is no longer part of the Jewish people. He's an apikoros. And he loses his status as being a part of Shomrei Torah mitzvahs. He doesn't have a Torah. He made up his own Torah. His Torah has 612 mitzvahs in it. So committing yourself is an extremely important thing. With that, we can answer an interesting question. It says that when you'll come into Eretz Yisrael, do this mitzvah. So the Medrash comments, Asei mitzvah zu, fulfill this mitzvah in order that in its merit you should be able to conquer Eretz Yisrael. Very nice. Keep the mitzvah Bikurim, and in the merit of the mitzvah Bikurim, you will inherit the land. It's very nice, except it's impossible. Because the mitzvah of Bikurim did not start till 14 years after they were already in Eretz Yisrael, conquered it, and settled it. Took 7 years to conquer the land, another 7 years to divide it up and settle it. At that point, after 14 years of conquering and dividing, that's when, if you planted things and the first fruits that grew after that, the mitzvah Bikurim applied to. Anything that was grown before those 14 years, in the first 14 years, the mitzvah did not apply to. So that's the case. They couldn't fulfill the mitzvah Bikurim till they were in Eretz Yisrael already for 14 years, finished conquering it and dividing it up. So how could doing this mitzvah be the merit in order to inherit Eretz Yisrael when this mitzvah never even took place before they already conquered it? Huh? You're listening. The answer is the commitment. Commit yourself to do this mitzvah, even though you're not going to do it for 14 years. But if you commit yourself that when you conquer Eretz Yisrael and divide it, eventually you're going to bring the first fruits to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then in that schar, you will, it's as if you did it already. And in that merit of committing yourself to the mitzvah, you will inherit the land. The deeper idea is why committing yourself to this mitzvah? Because this mitzvah shows that you believe that God gave you the land. You didn't take it by your own strength. Kochi voltsim yodi. So before you go and fight all the wars to conquer it, before you divide it up, you already commit yourself that when you'll have your first fruit, you're going to bring it to the temple and declare that God gave me this land. Then in the merit of committing yourself to that, all the conquering and all the dividing up will be clear that you're doing it understanding that God's giving you a present, not that you're taking it with force. That's the deeper idea. It's a shaila whether that's one of the 613 or it's a general mitzvah or it's not a mitzvah, what's it called specifically? What? Okay, it's a question whether that mitzvah is incumbent on every individual today till Mashiach comes or not. It's a shaila what the parameters of that mitzvah are of settling Eretz Yisrael. The people here, right, you can all hold that there's a mitzvah to settle Eretz Yisrael, you're mekayim that mitzvah, and you have the right to be on that side of the argument. People who aren't here, right, usually opt for the other side of the argument. Okay, that's a second idea. So we have two ideas why the first is important. The first represents the foundation. It represents the commitment. I'm committing myself, right, to a future thing when I start off with the first the right way. And the third idea is that firsts are exciting. You haven't got used to something yet where it became old hat, hackneyed, right? It's exciting. First is always an exciting thing, right? A bar mitzvah bacher, the first time he puts on tefillin, it's something special. The 983rd time you put on tefillin in your life, not as special as that. So new, first things are new, and new things are exciting, and you do it with a lot more intention, with a lot more hislavus, with a lot more fervor, and therefore the Rabbanu Shlom said, I want you to take the first, which by nature are more exciting, and dedicate them because it's going to be more meaningful. Yes?
But why isn't the first day of the week specified as something special?
First day of the week. Good question. Good question. We find the first day of the month is, and the first day of the year, which we'll get to in a second. Why not the first day of the week?
Because it's part of Shabbat. You don't commit to the next Shabbat.
What you're saying is not bad. The
looking forward to Shabbat.
Really, the first day of the week is Shabbos.
No. Shabbos is Yom HaShvi'i.
True.
So that's the last.
But Shabbos is also the day preceding the 6 days, as well as the day culminating. I didn't plan to speak about this, but since there's a great question. Okay, why talk? Rosh Chodesh is the beginning of a month, is special. And Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of a year, it's special. So why isn't the beginning of the week special? This could be an answer. Let me explain what it means. You're right. Shabbos is the seventh day. Right? That's pretty obvious, but it's not so obvious. I'll tell you
what. The first day of the week is not really the first day.
Why?
The first day of the week is... is only the beginning of the creation. The first day is Shabbat, because on Shabbat it's completed and then it's done and it's finished. And therefore, Shabbat is the item. You dedicate the firstborn, not when he's conceived, but when he's born, because it's the completion of the process.
I hear.
Shabbat is the completion of...
How about Rosh Chodesh? Rosh Chodesh isn't the completion of the month, it's just one day in the month. But you're right, but it doesn't represent something that's incomplete.
But when you talk about Shabbat, you're talking about creation of the world.
Right. Okay.
When you're talking about Rosh Chodesh, you're talking about an ongoing process. No, but it's an ongoing process. It's like a birthday. Yeah, the birthday is the first day of the year. It's not the same as the day you're born. There's a qualitative difference there. And therefore, Shabbat is the completion of creation. And
I hear. You can't celebrate the first day of the week because it's incomplete.
It's incomplete.
Regarding creation, the first day is an incomplete day. So you can celebrate every week creation when it's completed. Okay. But let me tell you the other side, that we do celebrate the beginning of the week. Shabbos, though, is also the beginning of the week. Where do I know that from? First of all, it's in my book, in case you want to know. Right away in the beginning. But it's the idea is the following. There's a Gemara that says like this. Somebody's lost in the desert, and he loses track of time. He doesn't know what day it is. So what does he do? So there's two opinions. One opinion is that as soon as he realizes he doesn't know what day it is, it could be any day of the week, he considers that day Friday, and the next day, in other words, the immediate coming day is Shabbos. He starts a cycle making that Shabbos. Okay? He doesn't know it's really Shabbos. He doesn't know. So he keeps Shabbos that first day, and then he counts 7 days, and again keeps the Shabbos and keeps that cycle up. So he starts with Shabbos and goes on 6 days and another Shabbos. The other opinion says no. The day that he doesn't know what day it is, that day he makes Sunday. And he counts 6 days, and 7 days later he makes Shabbos. The question is, when you lose track of time in the desert, do you make the first day Sunday or the first day Shabbos? And the Gemara explains what the reasoning is. The one who says that you make the first day Sunday, because that's the way the world was created. Started on Sunday, ended on Shabbos. So you're now recreating the cycle of creation. Start with Sunday, end with Shabbos. But that's from God's standpoint. From man's standpoint, when was man created? On Friday afternoon. The first full day that he experienced was Shabbos. So from man's standpoint, Shabbos began his week. It didn't end. From God's standpoint, Shabbos ended the week. So Shabbos has in it both the concept of beginning, from back to creation from man's standpoint, and end from God's standpoint. Where do we see that Shabbos has both of these things? So Shabbos obviously is the culmination. It's what's it called? That's obvious. But there are many things that we do where the Shabbos before the event is special. Shabbos before Yom Kippur is Shabbos Shuvah. Shabbos before Pesach is Shabbos HaGadol. Shabbos before a bris is a Shalom Zachar. Shabbos before a chasana is an ufruf. Every occasion, the Shabbos before is significant. That means, and the reason is, because it says that the power of the week. God created the world to exist 6 days. That's what it says. God made the world 6 days, not in 6 days, not bisheshes yomim. He created it for 6 days. That's what the Zohar says. And it has the power to exist for 6 days. What recharges the battery and gives it the power to exist another 6 days? Shabbos. So that means that Shabbos is the energy source for the next 6 days. So whatever's going to happen during the next 6 days gets its energy source from the previous Shabbos. So in that respect, Shabbos precedes the 6 days. So if that's the case, we do celebrate the first of the week in a way by making Shabbos special. It's both the culmination, and it's also the culmination of the previous week, and it's the beginning of the coming week. It has both aspects to it. Okay.
Also, it's what I said before while you were talking, it just struck me also. Rosh Hashanah is Briyat HaOlam, and we celebrate the first of the year. But in effect, God started creation on Kaf Hei Be'ilul.
Right.
Yeah?
It's the creation of man. Rosh Hashanah.
But it's also, we say it's Briyat HaOlam.
Right.
Okay? And it also goes, we celebrate Rosh Hashanah when God completed making the world, which also goes to your thing that has the conclusion.
Right. I hear. Okay. Rosh Hashanah also is on the sixth day of creation, not the first day of creation.
Yeah.
Was the act of making Havdalah had a bearing on this question, because you're in a way making the division between Shabbos and the weekdays, but you're also starting the week on Motzei Shabbat. You don't start it on Sunday morning.
I hear.
So could there be something in that?
Could be, except that every day starts the night before, so it's not that significant to Shabbos itself, but you're right. The whole concept of Havdalah is this is the beginning. We start a week with Kedusha preceding it, so we know how to use the weekday. So Nike Shabbos has both ideas, so that's one answer, and the other answer said, okay, good. In any case, so that's what's it called, also the another reason why firsts are important, because of the commitment and because they're fresh, new, something that you do with extra fervor, whatever. Based on all of this, we can answer the following question, which is very relevant to the time of year that we're in, preparing for Rosh Hashanah. It says that there is a halacha that one should be extra machmir during Aseret Yemei Teshuva more than the whole year. It gives an example. Somebody who is not careful to eat Pas Yisrael the whole year. Now let me explain what that means. The rabbis prohibited eating baked goods that were baked by a goy. If the goy baked them completely, that's called Pas Akum, and it's usher to eat. However, that's only if they were baked by a private goy. But if they were baked by a baker commercially, then as long as there is no Jewish bread of equal quality or price, then you're allowed to eat bakery bread that's kosher. Obviously, there's a mashgiach to make sure that it's all kosher. But the baking process was done totally by a goy, it's okay to eat that. As long as it's not mahadrin, but it's okay. Now, many things in Chutz La'aretz fall into that category, right? Arnold's bread, Drake's cakes, all have a hechsher, but they are baked by goyim. They are not baked by a Jew. Some of them, see, if a Jew even starts the baking process or has any connection to it, right? For instance, the bread is baking, he throws something into the oven to make it bake a little faster, even a few seconds. That's good enough. So therefore, if there's a pilot light, and the Jew lit the pilot light, and then every time they light the stove, they light it from that pilot light, that's also considered as if the Jew baked it. Okay, so in some places, they make sure the mashgiach somehow initiates the process of the baking. But in many places, that's impossible. I used to be the mashgiach for the Chaf Kei in Miami for Arnold's Bread. They have a gigantic, the plant in St. Petersburg, I think. I don't remember where it was. And I used to go there once a month and make spot checks to make sure that they were only using kosher ingredients. They had a contract and they could only use certain things. If I caught something there that wasn't supposed to be there, they could lose their whole hechsher. And it, so coming in intermittently was enough. In any case, so one time Rabbi Center, who was the head of the Chafkei, called me and he said, we want to upgrade the Hashgacha. We want to make Arnold's Bread Pas Yisrael, not Goyisha baked, which is okay, but it's not ideal. We want to make it Jewish baked. So next time you go to the plant, tell the owner you want to turn off the oven, let it cool down, and then turn it back on. You turn it on. And since you turned it on, until they turn it off again, all the baking that's being done is because of your turning on the oven initially. So I come to the plant. You have to understand, we're not talking about an oven, no, a kitchen oven. We're talking about an oven that was bigger than this room, much bigger than this room. Right? Big, long oven, it was about a block long or whatever, a gigantic oven. So I tell the plant owner, I said, look, could you turn the oven off, let it cool down, and I'll turn it on again. He started laughing uncontrollably. He said, we haven't turned this oven off in 25 years. He said, we can't turn the oven off and let it cool down and you'll turn it on again. It doesn't work like that. This oven is in perpetuity. It's always on. It was always on. It will always be on. There's no way to turn it off and turn it on again, surely not to let it cool down unless we want to just close down our whole operation, which we're not prepared to do.
We found out who was the first person that switched it on.
What?
You could ask who the first person
was. No, the first person who switched it on, I guarantee you, was not Jewish. There wasn't a Jew in that city at that time, what's it called, in the annals of American history, except for me. In any case, the... what?
Arnold is a nice Jew.
Right. I think that's his last name, not his first name. The... right, Benedict Arnold. The... in any case, so let's get back to the... so the halacha is like this. You are... It's forbidden to eat if your neighbor baked you some bread, even if it's a 100% kosher. You're not allowed to eat it because it was baked by a goy. If a goyish baker commercially bakes bread, it's better to get Jewish baked bread. But under the circumstances that I said, there's no bread of equal quality or price, you're allowed to eat that, what's it called, goyisha baked bread. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, that's not aseres yemei tshuva. Even if you are lenient and you eat bakery, commercially baked bread by a goy, during the 10 days from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, you shouldn't eat it. Now, on the surface, that sounds ridiculous. Right? I would understand that if a person like is trying out, maybe this year I'm going to be frumer. Till now I was lenient and I ate Drake's cakes. But now, this year, I'm going to try to be extra frum, and I'm not eating Drake's cakes. I'm only going to eat Pas Yisrael, only Jewish baked things. So I'm going to try it out during Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. We'll see if it works. I would maybe understand that. Okay, look, you're being judged. You want to try to be better, so try to be better. But it's not talking about that. It's talking about a person who has his order in for Drake's cakes to break his fast Motzei Yom Kippur. He's not definitely not keeping this up more than 10 days, right? There's no way that I'm keeping this up after Yom Kippur. But till Yom Kippur, from Rosh Hashanah till Yom Kippur, I'm willing to do this. So it sounds like you're trying to put in an act over God, right? God's judging me now between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and I'm saying, look, God, look how frum I am. I don't eat Drake's cakes. And then Motzei Yom Kippur, God gives me a good judgment because, wow, I'm really good. And I fool him, I said, ha, fooled you. I eat Drake's cakes again now, but the judgment's over. Tough luck. Right? That's what it means. What's this purpose of doing something for 10 days that you know you're not going to continue?
Sacrifice.
Oh, one second. Why did I say it over here? Because it fits in with everything I said till now. Rosh Hashanah is not just the beginning of the year. It's the rachis of the year. Therefore, it has all those concepts that we said. It's the foundation. If somebody builds a house and he has a choice of using grade A cement or grade B cement. Now, grade A cement costs double grade B. He can't afford to use grade A cement in the whole house. But he says, you know what? I can't afford to use grade A cement in the whole house, but I'm going to use grade A cement in the foundation. Is that guy a hypocrite? Does it make sense? Of course. Because the foundation has to be stronger than the building, because the whole building stands on the foundation. So if you see somebody who's careful to use grade A cement in the foundation, but he doesn't use grade A cement in the rest of the building, there's some understanding to that. Therefore, I can't live without grape cakes the whole year. But at least when I'm creating the foundation of my coming year, I'm going to try to do it in the most perfect way possible, and I'm going to do it the most ideal way. It's not a hypocrisy. Makes sense. One thing. Secondly, true, I may not be able to keep these things the rest of the time, but I'm committing myself to at least know that it's something I can do, right, if I want to. And once I make that commitment to begin with, even if I break away from it afterwards, but at least I've shown that it's possible. If I would really put my mind to it, I could do it. And I did it for 10 days. Then maybe I'll continue. Maybe not. But at least I've made the commitment in the beginning. And lastly, I'm starting off a year. And it's all exciting. So in the excitement, I can already do things that I couldn't do normally on the day-to-day, humdrum, old hat things. So take advantage of the fact that you started a new year, and you're all excited, and it's something that you can really get into and do it in the most ideal way. So all three ideas apply to why a person would want to be extra strict during those first 10 days of the year, even though he knows he's not going to do it the rest of the year. It's not hypocrisy, but it's taking advantage of the rachis, taking advantage of that special time of the year, just like other things, and doing them in a way that is more ideal than you normally do them on a regular basis. It's not hypocrisy. That's the idea. Yeah.
Why is that different from saying, I accept the Torah and the Mitzvot, all except for one?
Because here it's not a question. Here it's okay. It's just as an idea of doing something in a better way, or in a permissible way. We're not talking about something that's prohibited. The person says, I'm only going to do this mitzvah these 10 days and after that I'm going to steal. We're not talking about that. We're talking about something specifically that is okay to do, but there's a better way of doing it.
No, the mitzvah that I'm thinking about that most people don't accept easily is legayish isha. Most people
there's no mitzvah to divorce your wife. Only if the circumstances arise where that becomes necessary. Just like there's no mitzvah to bury your wife unless she's dead. Right? It depends on circumstance. Right? There is a mitzvah to bury your wife. There's a mitzvah to bury your husband too. A mitzvah to bury every Jew. But only if they die. So same thing. There's a mitzvah to divorce your wife only if the circumstances present themselves.
Is it one of the 613?
It's a shaila. Whether it's a mitzvah or it's merely a procedure. That if you want to divorce your wife or if the situation comes where you have to, this is the way to do it. It's a shaila whether it's a mitzvah or it's just a procedure.
A shaila there.
Yeah. No, there is an opinion that gerushin is a mitzvah where it is warranted. For instance, where is it warranted? On the wife's side, if a wife commits adultery, right, with certain parameters or whatever, we know for sure the two witnesses that saw her commit adultery, mamash. So she's not allowed to live with her husband. So she has to get divorced. They're not allowed to live together. So she has to get divorced. Then it's a mitzvah on the husband to divorce. Or a woman says, my husband is abusive, right, I can't live with him. He's a terror, right? He beats me, he abuses me, or he's a drunkard, he's a gambler, whatever it may be. I can't live with the person. Then the Beis Din forces the man to divorce his wife, and then it's a mitzvah for him to do it. Okay? So those are the kinds of circumstances that would make divorce a mitzvah. But there's no mitzvah for a person to get married and get divorced, right? It's not a mitzvah that applies all the time. It's a mitzvah that applies upon certain circumstances arising. That's it. Yeah.
There is a mitzvah. Once you get divorced and your wife goes to remarry somebody else, to remarry her.
Right. Maybe she changed. Maybe the husband changed. He gave up gambling, went to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? He's not abusive anymore. And the woman says, you know, I'll give you another chance. Or if the woman didn't commit adultery, but she had a very bad reputation, right? So the husband said, look, I don't need a woman like this around the house. Right? She's not a good example to my children or to me or whatever, so I'm going to divorce her. But she's not legally prohibited to him. Then, if he sees that she does tshuva, take her back, as long as she doesn't marry somebody else. Okay, we're getting far afield over here. One more thing here. We have some time. the mitzvah of vidui maisa. Let me give you the background first, and then we'll see what the problem is, and I'll give you a few answers. At the end of 3 years, okay, you have 3 years. Every year is a different setup for trumas and maisras. Okay? Specifically Meiser, okay, the tenths. There are three kinds of tithes that we're required to give. There's what's called Meiser Rishon. Meiser Rishon goes to the Levi. Then there's Meiser Sheni. Meiser Sheni, you bring to Yerushalayim and eat it there. Or you redeem the food, bring the money to Yerushalayim, and buy food there and eat it. You eat it. But you have to eat it in Yerushalayim. That's called Meiser Sheni. And then there's Meiser Ani. That is a tithe that goes to the poor. Now, only two of these apply in any specific year. The first year of the Shemitah cycle, this year, is Meiser Rishon and Meiser Sheni. You give a tenth of your crop to the Levi, and a tenth you bring up to Yerushalayim and eat. Okay? So that's one-fifth right off the top. A tenth this and a tenth for this. Second year, next year, same thing. Meiser Rishon, Meiser Sheni. The third year of the Shemitah cycle, you substitute Meiser Ani for Meiser Sheni. You don't give the second tithe and bring it to Yerushalayim. Instead, you give it to the poor. So the third year of the cycle is you give the first Meiser to the Levi, and the other Meiser, you don't bring to Yerushalayim and eat it, you give it to the poor. The fourth year and fifth year are the same thing as the first and second year. The sixth year is the same thing as the third year. And the seventh year is Shemitah. There is no tithes because everything is Hefker. Everything is anyway. Anybody can come and take it. So there's no idea of giving a tenth. So that's the cycle. The first 2 years, Meiser Rishon, Meiser Sheni. Similarly, the fourth and fifth year, Meiser Rishon, Meiser Sheni. The third and sixth years, Meiser Rishon and Meiser Ani. So after a portion of the cycle is finished, the first 3 years, okay, you have 3 years to take care of all of this. Now, you have to take care of it year by year, meaning I can't give this year's crop for last year's Meiser, right? I have to give each year, but I don't have to actually give it out for 3 years. If I want to, I can save it. And at before the end of 3 years, I have to make sure that the Levi got what he's supposed to get, and the Kohen's supposed to get his, and the poor people get theirs. I can't save it or anymore. I have to get it out of my house and distribute it. The distribution, right? The actual tithing, the actual taking of the Meiser has to be done year by year. But the distribution you can do at the end of 3 years.
The end of the first cycle.
Right. End of the first cycle. Once you do that, in the fourth year, on Erev Pesach, of the fourth year, you come to the Beis HaMikdash, and you have to make the following declaration. Biarti HaKodesh Min HaBayis. I removed all of the holy things from the house, all the things that I'm not allowed to use, and I gave it to the Levi and to the widow and the orphan and the poor people, everything I gave to what it's supposed to be. Lo avarti mitzvosecha, I didn't transgress anything. Velo shochach, I didn't forget anything. I did everything. Osisi kechol asher tzivisoni, I did everything you commanded. And then we ask God, look down from the heavens and bless us, right? Because we've done what we're supposed to do. Bless us with prosperity and good rains or whatever and whatever. Okay. Now, that declaration is called by the rabbis vidui meiser, the confession concerning meiser. Now that does not sound like a confession. Confession is ashamnu, bogadnu, I confess, right, I did this bad and that bad and whatever. But this declaration is, God, I got everything out of the house, I gave it to who I'm supposed to give it to, right, I didn't transgress anything, I didn't forget anything, I did everything you said. What kind of confessions? I imagine somebody coming to Yom Kippur saying, okay, comes time now for confession of sins. Okay, God, I confess, I'm a tzaddik. I didn't do anything wrong, didn't forget anything, I did everything you told me. I confess. What kind of confession is that?
What if you didn't do it?
What?
What if you didn't do it?
If you didn't do it, then you're a liar. So, but we're talking where you can only say that if it's true. So why is that called confession? What confession is there? I confess I'm a tzaddik? I confess I didn't do anything wrong? What kind of confession?
Confess you're a liar.
No, but you did do it, right? So what's the confession over here? You did it, right? I understand it's a declaration. Why is it called confession? So the Sfarno says that had it not been for the sin of the golden calf, all of us would be Kohanim. There wouldn't be any Kohanim, Levim. Every Jew would be fit to be a Kohen. And then you wouldn't have to take these things and distribute it to the Kohen and the Levi. Keep it for yourself. But I confess that because my ancestors sinned with the golden calf, and I'm not a Kohen or a Levi, I have to distribute these things to other people. That's the confession. I did everything right, but had my ancestors not sinned, things would have been much different, much more ideal. I wouldn't have to give it away to other people. I would be able to keep it as a Kohen myself and eat it in holiness. I can't do that. I confess that I'm missing something. That's interesting. The confession here isn't, I did something wrong. I didn't do anything wrong. My ancestors did it thousands of years ago. I didn't serve any golden calf. But because they did it, I was diminished. It affected me. I'm confessing my inadequacy. That's one idea. That's the Sfarno. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yashaber Soloveitchik from Yeshiva University, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, said a different idea. He says that if you look carefully at the wording, the person says, "Asisi kichol asher tzivisoni." I did kichol, like everything you said. It could have said, "Asisi kol asher tzivisoni." I did everything you said. Kichol means just about, not exact. That's the confession. The confession is, I didn't do any sins. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't forget anything, but it wasn't exactly the way you wanted it. It could have been with more intention, right? It could have been with a lot more enthusiasm, right? I could have done it more perfectly. So I'm confessing that I didn't forget anything. I didn't do anything wrong, but it wasn't exactly the ideal. That's the confession. Kichol asher tzivisoni, and not kol asher tzivisoni. I have a different idea. What I think is the following. Imagine the following. Somebody makes you a trustee. They give you $1 million to disperse, to distribute, right? And they tell you exactly how they want to distribute it. Okay, but you are their, you're their trustee. I guess that's what you call it, yeah? To distribute these for, their agent. Their agent, and you distribute it 100% exactly as they want. Okay, do you owe that person a report at the end of the year, or since you did everything okay, you don't owe the person anything? obviously you owe him an accounting. You're accountable to him. He gave you $1 million. You are accountable now to come and say what you did with it. Even if you did everything exactly, but you're responsible to this person to give him an accounting, because you're accountable. That's vidui maisa. God gave you all of these things. He asked you, out of what he gave you, to give others to others. It's not yours, right? God gave you $10,000 worth of crops. He told you $1,000 I want you to give away. So you're not giving it from you. I gave you $9,000. $1,000 I gave to be distributed. So I entrusted you with distributing my funds. You owe me an accounting. That's called confession. I confess that I'm accountable. That's confession. The confession is not that I did anything wrong. The confession is that I am not free to do whatever I want, and if I did, even if I did everything 100% right, I owe you an accounting, a report. Right? There's a better word for it. I owe you an accounting. I guess that's what it is. Right? So that's the confession. It's called vidui. By making this declaration, I'm admitting that I'm accountable. That's the idea. So vidui is not only when you do something wrong. We come, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur especially, Slichos, right? It's not just to admit that we did things wrong, but it's to admit that God gave us life, he gave us a body, he gave us a soul, he gave us material possessions, and he told us how he wants us to use it. Even if we did everything 100% right, we're required to come and confess that we are accountable and we did what we were supposed to do. Because if not, then we used what he gave us in a way that is not proper. In a way that we basically are gone off it. That's what the Chedushi Harim says, and we'll end with this. On Ne'ilah of Yom Kippur, there's no time for the lengthy vidui, the lengthy confession. So we confess one sin. What is that sin? L'man nechtel me'oshek yodeinu. In order that we should stop stealing. We confess theft. So the Chiddush HaRim asks, that's the one sin that every Jew, man, woman, and child, once a year at Ne'ilah, has to confess that we're a bunch of robbers? Thieves? That's the Jewish people? We're all thieves? That's the one sin? Says the Chiddush HaRim the following. I'll tell you a marshal I love to give with this. In high school, secular high schools, so that many times they send scouts from sports teams or from firms to look for talented young men or women that if they would continue their education along the lines of that firm, they would make good engineers, good architects, good basketball players, whatever. So an engineering firm sends scouts to the senior class. They find somebody who's very, very astute at art and at what's it called, math, could make a great engineer if they just would go get the schooling. And they're looking for young, talented people who could be engineers. So they go over to this person and they say, we'd like to send you to college. We'll pay your college, your room, your board, spending money, everything. We'll put you through college. Take engineering. And when you become an engineer, you are to commit yourself to work for our firm for 5 years minimum. And we're willing to payroll your education. We think that you're going to make a great engineer. We're willing to payroll your education, put you through college, and get an engineer for our firm. So the guy signs on the dotted line, goes through college, becomes an engineer, comes to work for the firm. But instead of doing anything constructive, the whole day the guy sits and doodles. What sin is he guilty of? Theft. You took all that money and you didn't make good on your commitment. You said you'd work for the firm. You're not working for the firm. That's exactly our situation. God gave us a lot more than money. He gave us a body, a soul, material possessions, and he expects to see a return on his investment. He wants us to see that we work for his firm. We come to Eli Yom Kippur and we look back over the year and we see a lot of the times not only are we working for his firm, we're working for the competition. So we say, Rabbanu Shalom, this past year we've been thieves. We have basically used what you gave us with certain stipulations in a different, completely different way. So we're a bunch of thieves. We promise this year we'll stop stealing. That we'll start using what you gave us. That's the idea of confession, even if you did everything right. But you have to confess that you're accountable to the Rabbanu Shel Olam because he gave you everything on stipulation, and if you don't fulfill those stipulations, then you're basically a ganav. So you have to at least, you owe him at least to come and confess that you're accountable, even if you didn't do anything wrong. Kol shekein, if you did things wrong. That's the idea, and that's why this is called vidui meiser, the confession of the meiser. Even if you did nothing wrong, you're confessing your accountability. Yeah.